Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the most current May 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. We're going to start off with an article about the Sex Pistols getting back together, except without singer Johnny Rotten. Also, an interview with the great producer Lenny Warnicker, and a classic album review of Remain in Light by the Talking Heads. And I begin today's program with the article about the Sex Pistols titled, As Soon As We Plug In, We're the Sex Pistols. With a tattooed tearaway of a frontman, Steve Jones, Paul Cook, and Glenn Matlock are playing the songs that made their names and shook the world to increasingly demented crowds. Due to John Lydon's objections, they can't bill themselves the Sex Pistols, yet they insist they're upholding the band's incendiary spirit. It ain't karaoke, they tell Tom Doyle. September 26, 2024, and on stage at the O2 Forum in Kentish Town, North London, three of the original Sex Pistols are performing with a startling intensity, displaying the fire and skill that always belied the Malcolm McLaren contrived gimmick that they couldn't play their instruments. As bassist Glenn Matlock will put it to Mojo, describing the explosive chemistry between himself, drummer Paul Cook, and guitarist Steve Jones, as soon as we plug in and start playing, we're the Sex Pistols. Their new singer, Frank Carter, is halfway up a stage right staircase and climbing over a railing onto the lip of a balcony. As he belts out Satellite, the Holidays in the Sun B-side, that was John Lydon's ambivalent anthem to the suburban kids in those godforsaken new towns, where the Pistols sharpen their act with provincial gigs in the first months of 1976. And here's a little bit of the song Satellite by the Sex Pistols. Carter, now 40, was himself a kid when he first picked out the naughty-looking Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols, from his dad's CD collection, sometime in the 90s. Later, he was schooled in the hardcore punk of the 2000s with his band Gallows, in an era which required more Iggy Pop-inspired stage-diving physicality than Johnny Rotten ever dared to attempt. At the Forum, the tattooed, red-haired frontman gets ready to leap into the crowd, who are noticeably just a touch older than his usual mosh pit mobs, then propels himself into the air and is caught and carried aloft by a forest of hands. I have a very different audience than the Sex Pistols do, he says later, meaning the followers of his current group, Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes. At shows with the Pistols, he often finds himself in a circle pit of, 40 to 60-year-olds, big fucking lads who really want you to prove it. Reactions to Carter fronting a version of the Sex Pistols in a series of select shows beginning in the summer of 2024 and now extended to a world tour for 2025 have, for the most part, been wildly positive. But there have been the naysayers who've sometimes expressed themselves to the singer in very physical terms. I've had a few digs in the ribs, he beams proudly, but once you see a guy get punched and laugh it off, it charges the whole dynamic, because you just realize that this guy is more unhinged than you thought he was. I mean, he's nuts, man, getting in that crowd, Steve Jones quietly marvels. He's a little terrier, I tell ya, Paul Cook cackles. Having such an intrepid crowd-roaming frontman isn't always a boon, however. Some nights it has led them to losing their place in a song. The first night we did Satellites, says Matlock, it went a bit tits up. Frank was in the middle of the crowd, and we couldn't hear him, and you need to hang off the vocals a little bit sometimes. Maybe, the bassist adds with a grin, as a thought suddenly occurs to him, we should only pay him for the time he's actually on the stage. To be honest, if they want to cut my pay, I'll take it, laughs Carter. This whole situation is priceless to me anyway. The route to the Sex Pistols' comeback with Carter, 16 years after their classic lineup of Lydon, Jones, Matlock, and Cook, played a final Reformation-era gig in Spain in 2008, was a circuitous one. In the summer of 2023, the guitarist, drummer, and bassist all ended up on the same bill supporting Iggy Pop at Crystal Palace Park. Cook and Jones had joined forces and repertoires with Generation X's Billy Idol and Tony James in an outfit savvily named Generation Sex. Matlock was playing bass in Blondie, but missed his erstwhile bandmates, set due to being late to the site. I could hear the opening notes of Pretty Vacant, he remembers, but by the time I rushed up there, they'd done it. Later, Matlock and Cook hung out while Jones, jet-lagged after flying in from his adopted home of Los Angeles, returned to his hotel. But, as a bassist reveals, communications between the three had been ongoing as regards future Sex Pistols activity. We'd been very lightly talking about a way forward, he says. There were rumors that Steve Jones didn't much enjoy the Generation Sex experience. It was good, he states today, without sounding entirely convinced. I mean, I wouldn't mind doing more of that at some point, but then it kind of ended, and Billy was going to be doing touring or something else. So our manager said, why don't we go out and just do Sex Pistols songs? Find the singer. Then in 2024, Cook was moved to stage a benefit for Bush Hall, the one-time West London snooker hall turned music venue that was facing closure. The original idea was to get all different singers in to play Never Mind the Bollocks, Cook says. But it wouldn't probably been a bit too much getting five or six different people in. Instead, Glenn Matlock's son, Lewis, who along with his brother Sam had toured with the Rattlesnakes in their band, Dead, suggested, Carter, I said, well, let's meet up for a coffee. And I like the guy, Matlock Sr. recalls. I said, you're up for this? And he said, yep, I'm up for it. I know I'm going to get flack for it, but I've got big boots. And he rose to the challenge. At that point, all I was focused on was having one jam with them, says Carter. Genuinely, I just was like, I want that for myself. I just want to be in a room with the Pistols and play with them. Still, after an initial practice session with Cook and Matlock, Carter felt he had blown his chance due to an attack of nerves. I honestly thought I'd fucked it up, he says. It was the worst audition of my life. You think you know those songs, and then when you look at the lyrics, like Lydon's a genius, but it is hectic. Maybe he was a bit nervous, Cook says of Carter, but it didn't come across. He was pretty low-key. Subsequently, Matlock and Cook told Jones they believed they'd found their man, and the guitarist flew over to London for further rehearsals. Frank was nervous even when I got over there, says the guitarist. He kept forgetting the lyrics, whatever. We just tried to make him feel as comfortable as possible, and then it started falling into place. At the first of three shows at Bush Hall on August 13th of last year, Carter proved his worth. As soon as we stepped on stage, says Cook, all hell broke loose. It was so exciting. We went into Holidays in the Sun, and it just went off the scale, and it never stopped. And here's a little bit of that song, Holidays in the Sun, by the Sex Pistols. By the time the new lineup returned in September for a five-date UK tour ending at the Forum, two songs from the post-Lydon era of The Great Rock and Roll Swindle had crept into the set list. Cook and Jones' rousing pop-punker Silly Thing and their propulsive Sid Vicious fronted take on My Way. I mean, it's a good song, but it's got connotations, says Matlock of the latter, presumably meaning that it was sung by the man who replaced him in the band. I kind of go along with it. And here's a little bit of the song My Way by the Sex Pistols.
Mm-hmm. And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. You can't, I'm not a queer. I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, and each and every highway has had much more than this. I did it my way.
For his part, John Lydon has predictably likened the Carter-fronted incarnation of the group to a karaoke Sex Pistols. It's a typically harsh put-down, but in truth, a hollow one. On stage, Carter sounds very much like his intense, roaring self, a bet singing Pistols songs. He's put his own spin on it, that's for sure, says Cook. I mean, it'd be ridiculous to try and imitate John anyway. A lot of people have tried in the past and just end up sounding like Steptoe or something. Frank's got a really melodic voice. I think that brings something new to the Pistols, really, without all the shouty-shouty. It ain't karaoke, Carter firmly states in his defense. John is going to have his opinion, and he's very entitled to them. I'd love to sit down with him and just explain to him what he means to me and how grateful I am to not just hold that torch, but pour some gasoline on it. Recent years have seen relations between John Lydon and his estranged Pistols bandmates plummet to a low only comparable to the fallout of their initial split. Following their messy final phase, one gig at the Winterland Ballroom in San Francisco on January 14, 1978. The intervening years of acrimony and recrimination made their eventual reunion for the Filthy Lucre World Tour in 1996 all the more surprising. Matlock remembers tensions in the air at the band's first rehearsal after a 19-year break in Los Angeles that year. John wouldn't sing, he says. Steve and Paul got fed up and left. And then I picked up Steve's guitar, and me and John went through the set together. It was a little bit of bonding. I think he was maybe a bit nervous, too. If you've spent a lifetime snipping at somebody, he adds with a laugh, and then you're in a room with the people you've been having a go at, you're probably feeling a little bit cagey. Steve Jones now says that while money was certainly a key motivator in his decision to rejoin the band, he also felt he had something to prove, to show people that we could play, he says. There was always that stigma. Them guys can't play. And I think we played better than ever on that tour. That much was evident from the opening moments of their return show at Finsburg Park on June 23, 1996, when the Pistols kicked into bodies and the crowd of 30,000 erupted. That was our first gig back in the UK since 1977, wasn't it? Cook double checks with Mojo, and it was huge. It was one of my favorite Pistols gigs. We were back on it. The Filthy Lucre tour ended after 72 shows, and a further 32 gigs followed in 2008 as part of the Cash Reaping Columbine Harvester Tour. By the end of that jaunt, a chasm had opened up once again between Lydon and the others. "Yeah, not my favorite tour," Jones attest. "It started getting horrible at the end. You know, the old resentments. It made me say, fuck this, I'm never going to do this again." Cook lays the blame on the singer's dark moods, killing the vibe. It seemed like he was kind of taking revenge a little bit for something that was bugging him, he says. Then you just wonder, why the fuck are we putting ourselves through all this again? Matlock has his own theory about Lydon's deeper feelings regarding the Sex Pistols. "I think he resents, in some kind of strange way, having to be Johnny Rotten. You know, he wants to be John Lydon. But because of the three of us, he had to become Johnny Rotten. And then he sort of painted himself in a corner." Steve Jones sees it differently, however. "No, I don't think he was resenting being Johnny Rotten," he counters. "I think John was getting off on being Johnny Rotten. He is Johnny Rotten, you know." In 2021, simmering intra-band grievances spilled over into court. Jones and Cook, with the support of Matlock, overruled their former singer's objection to having the band's songs used in Pistol director Danny Boyle's polarizing 2022 TV Ministries based on Jones's 2016 memoir, Lonely Boy. "They don't need my forgiveness," Lydon quietly seethed to Mojo in 2023. "They've made their decision. Them as people, I don't need them in my life." Lydon did, however, admit to having sat through the whole of Pistol. "Yes, I had to. It was grim, grim watching to see those boys throw away their legacy. Really, really hurts." As it turns out, Matlock didn't much like Pistol either. "I was a bit embarrassed, really," he admits, having taken a particular exception to the reinforcement of the narrative that he was kicked out of the band. He still insists he quit. "The way Glenn was portrayed in it, I didn't really agree with that," says Cook. "That was the main beef, really. I thought that was quite bad. And I just thought the whole thing could have been a bit more down and dirty than how it was. A bit grittier, really." "I would say I was 90% happy with it," says Jones, while claiming that he can't clearly remember the details of Matlock's departure. He points out that Cook recently reminded him that the pair of them went away to the Canary Islands for a week. "And when we come back, Glenn had gone. I know me and Cookie just went along with it. I don't think we had a lot of input in it. I didn't see eye to eye with John, and there you go," says Matlock, who, of course, was to enjoy his moment of vindication when he was asked back into the band in 1996. "I don't want it to come across nasty," he stresses, "but when the Pistols reform, they could get anybody who's pretty good on the bass to do it. And they always ask me. So I kind of feel I have the last laugh a little bit, really. Not in a snide way, but in a kind of, yeah, that'll do nicely kind of way." Lydon himself has been through a tough time of late, losing his wife, Nora Forrester, in April 2023, followed by a death of his friend and manager, John Rambo Stevens, later that same year. Cook says the band attempted to reach out to him. "We did try around that time, but didn't get no response." It's very sad, says Matlock. There's people writing to me, you know. You should speak to John. And all that. Well, my dad died of Alzheimer's. Nobody called me. Two wrongs don't make a right. But what can you do? He lost his missus, and he lost his best mate, which has got to be rough. Jones sympathizes. I wish him all the best. John, I've got no egg with him. Which begs the question, with the Pistols expected to be a big international live draw in 2025, what would the others say if, in a surprise twist, Lydon decided that he wanted back in the band? I wouldn't believe him, Matlock instantly responds. You'd definitely make a lot more dosh, Jones pragmatically points out. But is it worth it? If it's going to be that same old bullshit, you know? You never know, though. Things change, people change. I don't think that'll ever happen, Cook says, of the chances of the full Pistols reunion. But if it ever does, we'll come to that when it does happen. One person who'd be dismayed by this a bit improbable development, of course, is Frank Carter. I would be disappointed, he offers. Of course I would. But look, if that ever was to happen, I would just take the thanks from the rest of the world, because what an honor to be part of that getting back together. In the meantime, there are other possibilities to consider, including a live Frank Carter / Sex Pistols album. Yeah, why not? Jones says. You definitely wouldn't have to overdub the crowd noise, that's for sure. More contentious is the notion that the four might also explore writing new material. Options about that vary within the band. There were a couple of ideas floating around in 96, which John wouldn't write lyrics for, Matlock discloses. I think they still could slot in, you know, but we'll see. I think that was 2008, says Jones, when we were rehearsing. We had a couple of ideas. It was just a couple of riffs or whatever, but nothing happened with them. I think I used them on the Professionals album, actually, Cook laughs, meaning 2017's What in the World, by the band he started with Jones in 1979, and then revived with most of its original members in 2015. Frank Carter is, at least in theory, open to the idea of writing new Sex Pistols lyrics, even if he has one likely deal-breaking condition. I would do it, of course, he says. It wouldn't be the Sex Pistols, obviously, unless I could sit down and write the lyrics with John. But again, that's just opening a can of worms. There's so much history between them, and it's delicate ground. For me personally, I think when a band like us starts playing new material, that's when everybody goes to the fucking bar, offers Jones, bluffly. They're not interested. And on recent evidence, there are not many queuing for drinks when Frank Carter and the Sex Pistols are up on stage and in such fiery form. For now, the band are more than happy to celebrate the immaculate canon of Nevermind the Bollocks and Ancillary Songs Live and Loud, and with an infusion of new frontman energy. It's been really, really fun to talk about to their friends and family, says Carter. People come up to me and they just give me a big old shake. And they'll tell me I've never seen them this happy, never seen so many smiles on the stage. I just think, fuck, that's what it's all about. If you're going to be doing this, like 50 years on, if you ain't smiling, why the fuck are you up there? Moreover, reckons Carter, now as then, the band exists as an essential lightning rod for people's rage. To me, he states, with the insider knowledge of a fan-turned frontman, now is the time we need a band like the Pistols more than ever. And now, the Mojo interview with famous producer Lenny Warnicker. One of the last great record men, the artist A&R in the golden age of Warner Brothers and beyond, counselor to Prince, Van, Randy, Elliott Smith, and more, shares his wisdom. Producing is hard, says Lenny Warnicker. Sat in the kitchen of his West Los Angeles home on an early winter's day, absorbing the first of many questions, Lenny Warnicker closes his eyes and bows his head in a state of deep concentration. Warnicker, one of the business's most storied producers, A&R, and label execs, and among the most loved by musicians, ascribes his prayer-like posture to a childhood spent on Hollywood studio sound stages, witnessing classic film scores being recorded. His father, Cy Warnicker, was a violinist who'd later help chorale orchestral musicians at 20th Century Fox for Oscar-winning composer-conductor Alfred Newman. "My father wasn't a strict man, except in that environment," recalls Warnicker. "When the orchestra were ready to record, a bell would ring. He would say to me, 'Don't move.' He might have said, 'Don't breathe,' as well. It's the way I've listened to music or anything ever since." The 83-year-old Warnicker delivers his words in soft, measured tones as he recounts a life devoted to helping artists realize their creative potential. The first great discovery came at just 10 years of age when he recognized the unique gifts of his friend Alfred Newman's nephew, Randy, whom he would later sign and produce. When Warnicker was a teenager, his father saw the studio system collapsing and put up the family's furniture as collateral to fund the launch of Liberty Records. Initially focused on orchestral and film music, the label moved into pop market with hits by Julie London and the Chipmunks, and entered the fledging field of rock and roll with Eddie Cochran, Fats Domino, and Jan and Dean. Besotted by the music business, the young Warnicker served a long apprenticeship with Liberty before moving to Warner Brothers in 1965. Over the next three decades, Warnicker and label head Mo Osteen would build one of the most successful and respected record companies in the world, a rare haven for art and artist in a bottom-line-obsessed industry. In the early 90s, corporate machinations pushed the pair out of the paradise they'd created, and Warnicker and Osteen went on to found DreamWorks Records. These days, Warnicker is largely retired and somewhat at a loose end. "One morning, you wake up and realize, 'I don't have to do shit anymore,'" he says, chuckling. "I'm still trying to come to terms with that." As he reflects on his 70 years of music as a key facilitator for Brian Wilson and Elliott Smith, the Everly Brothers and Prince, the modest Warnicker downplays his contributions, but more than merely bumping into geniuses, Warnicker actively sought them out, bringing his deft touch to the careers of cult stars and superstars alike. This is fun. This is a fun way to go back and remember and be part of the stuff you've done, he says, recounting the details from some distant recording session. "When you've been doing it for as long as I have, you start to forget." Beyond the music you heard hanging out with your father, how much of an influence was it being exposed to the old Hollywood studio system? "Well, the whole concept of the studio system really affected me, the notion that it was like a university or something. Later, at Warner Brothers, Mo Osteen and I were both very interested in the studio system, and the guys who ran it. So we were always reading biographies about Irving Thalberg, Louis B. Mayer, David Selznick. They were studied. That whole scene was studied. What to do, what not to do. In the mid-60s, when I first got to Warner's, some of those ideas were still usable. In my mind, I wanted to put together some combination of 20th Century Fox and Motown. What was the first music that really affected you? Well, as a little boy, my mom took me to see An American in Paris. The theme to the movie was incredible. And you've got the visual of Gene Kelly and Leslie Caron dancing in this blue, almost psychedelic backdrop. I was 9 or 10 years old, so sex wasn't like a big thing yet. But it was a little question mark. And when I heard that tune, I said, I think I know what sex is like, because it got to me that way. You played piano as a kid, but gave it up early on. I imagine it was hard to feel competent when your best friend happens to be Randy Newman. Randy and I had the usual relationship that kids have. We played baseball and football and basketball and all of that. But the other half of it was music. He would turn each other on to stuff. He's a couple years younger, but he was way ahead of me. Once he really started to focus, he was so far ahead. I'm still taken by his talent and my own ability to recognize it at such a young age. And just get the hell out of the way. One time, each of us was supposed to write a song for something. Maybe his dad wanted us to do it. Anyway, I wrote some stupid poem-like thing, which is all I was capable of. And Randy worked on this piece of music, this instrumental. And when he finally played it, I just knew he was gifted. Because the chord changes, the melody, it didn't feel like it was coming from a kid. He was only 7 or 8 at the time. Your father started Liberty Records in the mid-50s. For a kid, it must have been amazing hanging out with that first generation of rockers like Eddie Cochran. Well, my father loved Eddie Cochran, though he was a great musician. Eddie was a really good-looking guy and a glass-half-full type, just a lot of energy and a sweetheart. I was 16 or 17, and my father had a meeting with him. I'm sitting in on this fairly serious meeting with Eddie and his producer-manager, Jerry Capehart. Eddie came in to play his new record. I'm in the corner, but close enough to hear. The record starts, and it is perfect. I mean, everything happened in this little record. It was amazing. Because I had hung out at the record company for a while, I'd pick up some music business jargon. When the record finished, I couldn't control myself, and I blurted out, "That's unfucking believable." Eddie looked at me and said, "I want that kid in all my meetings." The record he played was Summertime Blues. Can you imagine? Well, something like that will get you hooked on the music business. And here's a little bit of that song, Summertime Blues, by Eddie Cochran. I'm a gonna raise a fuss, I'm a gonna raise a holler. About a working old summer just to try to earn a dollar. Every time I call my baby, try to get a date, my boss says,
no dice, son, you gotta work.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Oh, well, my mom and papa told me. You went to college, but at the same time, you were learning the ropes at Liberty, working as a gopher for producer Snuff Garrett, doing radio promotion, and eventually moving to the label's publishing arm, Metric Music. where you first started producing. Well, in those days, you had maybe $50 or $60 to make a songwriting demo. You could only pay the musicians teeny amounts. But there were young guys around who wanted in, who were really good. People like Leon Russell and Dr. John were making demos. There was plenty of talent to do the work cheap. You couldn't get the big name session guys, and after a while, you didn't really want them. So I made a lot of demos and learned how to multi-track. I learned how to work with musicians. After your move to Warner's, you had hits for the Mojo Men, Sit Down, I Think I Love You, and Harper's Bazaar, the 59th Street Bridge song, Feeling Groovy. But quickly, you gravitated toward more esoteric acts, signing your old pal Randy Newman and Van Dyke Parks. What was the attraction there? I was always interested in working with somebody unique and interesting, maybe not obviously commercial, but that, if they ever got played on the radio, people might jump on it. It was actually Mo who brought up Randy to me. Randy had been a songwriter, but it was clear he needed to be an artist. He already had a big reputation in town with musicians and a handful of producers. Mo came to me and said, "Do you know about this guy, Randy Newman?" Laughs. I said, "Yeah, he's my best friend. And I've hesitated to say anything to you because he is my best friend." But we went after him and ultimately got him. When I was at Metric, there was a songwriter I was working with, Rita Martinson, and she said, "I want to play you this song by Van Dyke Parks." And she played me High Coin. And I said to her, "Rita, your guy didn't write that. That's an old turn-of-the-century number or something." And she really had to convince me. Later, I got a hold of Van Dyke, and we had a meeting. He came walking in and was exactly what I had expected, this little genius, somebody who had his own style and was very articulate. Too articulate, he played me 6 or 7 things that ended up basically being Parks' 1967 debut, Song Cycle. His music was coming from another world. I decided I'm going to sign this guy on the spot. I'm sure we negotiated, but that's when I approached him about it. I said, "I think I love you." And here's a little bit of the song High Coin from Van Dyke Parks. In the early days at Warner's, you tried to sign the Buffalo Springfield. Do you think if they'd signed with you instead of Atlantic, their story would have turned out differently? At the time, I was just a little A&R guy, so it wasn't likely to happen. I mean, Neil Young was the only one that I was able to have any kind of talking relationship with when I was going backstage to see the band. Richie Fury, he was a very nice guy, but he wasn't around. Stephen Stills was dismissive. Dewey Martin was fucked up. And there was Neil. For whatever reason, we became friendly. He was always the guy I would go to. Many years later, after he'd had a tremendous success at Warner's Reprise, Neil told me, "If the Springfield had gone with you, I think the band would still be alive." That was the greatest compliment I ever got. In 1968, you produced the Everly Brothers' conceptual country rock album, Roots. How tough were they to deal with? That was a last-ditch effort because they hadn't had much success in a while. They were at a difficult place with each other, too. You could sense the tension. They hadn't written anything. Phil was into Italian love songs, and Don, he was the scary one, because he could be explosive. When we were almost finished, they said to me, "This is the worst thing we've ever done." They were going on tour for a little while, and I told them, "Give me a chance to put it together, and then we'll see what we've got." Well, it didn't end up being a big seller, but it's considered an important record now, and one of the things I'm most proud of. Wasn't it on the Everly Brothers project that you connected with Ry Cooder? Yeah, I got a call from Jack Nitschke, who said, "I've been working with this guy you have to meet. He's an unbelievable guitar player, and we have this idea for a song for the Everlys." I'd heard about Ry Cooder, just the name made me think he was in his 30s or 40s. Jack comes in with Ry, and he was a kid, 19 or 20. Ry pulled out his guitar and a bottleneck. I didn't even know what a bottleneck was. When I heard him play, I thought, "Oh my God, I've heard that sound before. I always thought it was a harmonica or something." Anyway, we never ended up doing the song with the Everlys, but that was the start of things with Ry, who we also signed. You made a lot of records with Randy, Ry, and Van Dyke before any of them had hits. You must have met with some resistance within the company. I know there's the famous story of you playing Song Cycle for Warner's president, Joe Smith, and him saying, "Where's the song?" And he wasn't trying to be funny either. Van Dyke will quote that forever happily. Don't know which project it was. It might have been a Randy record or a Ry record or one of the singles that Van Dyke and I kept doing. But I realized at a certain point that these things are going to be a tough sell. It's like you're climbing a mountain and it's probably vertical. I knew what we were up against, but I really believed it was the right thing to do. That kind of belief became part of Warner Brothers' reputation as a label that nurtured and stuck with artists. I suppose that paid off with a group like Fleetwood Mac. Well, we got lucky there. They started with Peter Green and then had a period with Bob Welch, and they'd had a small hit, but they were kind of mid-level act, mid-level but good, though certainly not somebody you'd ever bank on selling 40 million records. But they were making some money for the company, so it seemed stupid to let them go. Not that we were smart enough to know anything about what Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks were about to bring to the table. That's all down to Mick Fleetwood. But yeah, that was an instance where it certainly paid off. It's still paying off for Warner's. Along with Russ Titelman, you made some really evocative records in the 70s, particularly Newman's Sail Away and Good Old Boys. Your cinematic rooting is interesting because your work always had that quality. You can almost see the music as much as hear it. Well, in sessions, whenever we would talk about an approach, it was always, "What does this track look like?" Even today, if I'm in the studio, the first thing I ask is, "What's the song look like?" And this is where I'm going to stop to leave enough time for the classic album review, but I will continue this article next week. And the classic album review this week is The Talking Heads' Remain in Light, 1980. Originally entitled Melody Attack, Remain in Light is Talking Heads' greatest statement, the last and most accomplished of the trio of albums they recorded with Brian Eno. Recorded at a fracturous point in the Heads' history, it can be viewed as a fight for leader David Byrne's attention between the other group members, Tina Weymouth, Chris France, and Jerry Harrison, and producer and co-writer Eno. This creative tension makes for a continuously invigorating listen. After recording all the basic tracks, the band regrouped in New York in summer 1980 to complete the work. Fighting writer's block, Byrne sculpted the jams, often simple variations on one chord, into recognizable songs. With layer upon layer of vocal groove and percussion, the record's intermeshing rhythms still leave the listener breathless. From the African-inspired The Great Curve to the Curtis Blow-influenced Cross-Eyed and Painless. And here's a little bit of that song, Cross-Eyed and Painless, by the Talking Heads, from their album Remain in Light.
Lost my shit, trying to act casual. Can't stop, I might end up in the hospital. Changing my shape, I feel like an accident. They're back to explain their
greatest jam, however, Weird Guitar Riff Song, became Once in a Lifetime, with its allusions to the work of Fela Kuti and Byrne emulating the rapture of Preachers. And here's a little bit of that song, Once in a Lifetime, by the Talking Heads, from their album Remain in Light.
Find yourself in another part of the world, and you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile, and you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife, and you may ask yourself,
in October 1980, Remain in Light ably demonstrated that pop could be both for your head and your feet. The making of the album divided the group smartly into two camps, Eno and Byrne and Weymouth and France, with Harrison playing mediator. Although Eno was to leave the equation, the tension from this record dogged the group and led to their split 10 years later. Things did not look good when Talking Heads assembled in the Bahamas to start recording their fourth album, Remain in Light. According to bassist Tina Weymouth, longtime Heads producer Brian Eno was reluctant to become involved again, having fallen out with David Byrne during recording of their collaborative album, My Life in the Bush of Ghost. Within a week, engineer Rhett Davies quit in frustration, and Byrne has confirmed that there was tension between himself and Weymouth over the direction of the music. He has said, for example, we were really intrigued and excited by the formal aspects of African music. She, however, insisted no one discussed with us the fact that we were going to be playing in an African style. An album of brave inventions and haunting textures drooled NME on release, but Rolling Stone nailed it even better with scary, funny music to which you can dance and think and dance, dance and think, ad infinitum. Predictably, though, the world wasn't ready for doing two things at once. It was the worst-selling Talking Heads album ever, points out France. Tightly formatted, American radio found it impossible to program because, as Byrne recalls, the reaction we heard was that it sounded too black for white radio and too white for black radio. By the end of the 80s, however, Remain in Light featured at number 4 in Rolling Stone's selection of the decade's greatest albums. There's another song on that album titled Houses in Motion.
In cold weather, I knew my heart was in the right place. I knew I'd be able to do these things. As we watch him digging his own grave, it was important to know that was where he's at. Can't afford to stop, that is what he believed. He'll keep on digging for 1,000 years.
Unfortunately, once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the May 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the interview that I started today with famous record producer Lenny Warnicker. Mojo's Essential Guide to Record Store Day 2025, The Doobie Brothers, Spark Up Album 16, and a classic album review of one of my favorites, Pearl Jam's Verses. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.